Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll meet a local horror filmmaker about why the new movie he produced is perfect for Valentine's Day and why Frida Kahlo has become the icon of women in art. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
When Florida can have their results between 10 and 12 o'clock on the same day, why would we not respond to the voters who overwhelmingly, over two-thirds of Arizona voters, and even more at the national level, would like to know the results on the same day?
This bill would severely limit ballot drop-off options and shorten return times, disproportionately hurting rural, indigenous, elderly, and low-income voters.
This is for low to middle-income people. We want them to make more money. We want them to give better service. We want to provide and support those people that work in these industries.
Over the last few weeks of the Trump administration and the past few weeks of the beginning of the 57th legislative session, we have seen Republican elected officials work to make our country unwelcoming to immigrants.
She'll always put hardworking Arizonans first.
You're going to have my support.
Endorsed by President Trump, Karen Taylor Robeson for governor.
Everything we've learned about Colonel Gabbard during her confirmation process suggests that she is not the person for this job.
And with me to talk about Karen Taylor Robeson officially entering next year's gubernatorial race, lawmakers approving a measure they say will speed up election results and more, are Paul Bentz of High Ground. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
And Mike Hayner of Lumen Strategies. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Paul, let's start with Karen Taylor Robeson. This has long been rumored that she would jump into the gubernatorial race, and this week she did. What kind of impact do you think she will have on this race? Of course, Congressman Andy Biggs has already announced he's running.
Well, I think it's going to be a very competitive Republican primary. Andy Biggs is a pretty well-known commodity, especially in the Freedom Caucus circles. That being said, she gave Carrie Lake quite a run for her money 4 years ago in the last gubernatorial primary. She's an incredibly well-funded candidate. And most importantly, it would appear at this point that she has Trump's endorsement. I think we're seeing some polling and some other information out there trying to sort of knock that off and try to cut into that, maybe give the president some doubts about that. But with the president's endorsement and a well-funded campaign, she's got to be a front runner at this point.
How much of that? Obviously, you said give Carrie Lake a run for her money. Money maybe being the operative phrase there, because as you say, Karen Taylor Robeson will be very well-funded. How significant is the Trump endorsement in that primary?
Well, what we've seen is that the Trump endorsement, whether it is in the congressional race and CD8 for Abe Hamadeh
in the West Valley
or in the Senate race for Blake Masters previously. And throughout Arizona, Trump's endorsement is good as gold. He has incredible sway over the primary electorate. And we're looking at a head-to-head race. And certainly Andy Biggs is incredibly MAGA and has been from before it was cool, as
he was MAGA before there was MAGA
and Tea Party and everything else. But the challenge that Biggs is going to have is that he has not been a prolific fundraiser. He is very good on the rhetoric side. He's very good with the base, but he's never proven to be a particularly good fundraiser. And Karen Taylor Robeson is not only independently wealthy, but well-connected, has raised a lot of money for Trump, has raised a lot of money for the Victory Fund. And I think that puts her in a good position to talk to the electorate.
Mike, do you see this, as Paul does, as a pretty competitive primary?
I agree 100%. It's a very competitive primary. I disagree a little bit with Paul. I'm not sure that President Trump actually endorsed Taylor Robeson. He said that you would have my support. That doesn't necessarily mean it's an endorsement. We've seen in the past where he's endorsed two candidates in the same race. My expectation would be at some point he's going to endorse Andy Biggs as well. And so this race is going to be very, very competitive. And I think as Andy Biggs may not be a very good fundraiser, he has the support of Turning Points. And as Paul mentioned, he has the support of the base. And the base is who votes in the primary. And this election is all about the primary at this point. And I think Andy Biggs is going to give Karen Taylor Robeson a very good run for her money.
If you are Governor Katie Hobbs, at this point, do you have a preference as to who comes out of that primary?
I don't know, because that primary is 18 months away. We have no idea. We've seen seismic changes in the electorate's thought process over the last 4, 6, 8 years very quickly change. And so at this point, if you're wishing for one, you may get them and regret it.
Paul, we saw in Karen Taylor Robeson's announcement video, we've seen it in press releases, she's really talking about Donald Trump a lot. So to your point earlier about the importance of that endorsement and that support, it seems like she's really trying to lock it down, even though, as Mike pointed out, Andy Biggs even is kind of questioning, did he really endorse her? I'm not really so sure.
Well, he said in his speech that she'd have his support. I think that they're cozying up to the president and trying to ensure that they get that locked down. She's raised significant amount of money for him. She's raised significant amount of support for him. I suspect that this is all forays to ensure that she locks up that support. That being said, this is why we're seeing surveys out there right now showing that Andy Biggs has a lead. One of the surveys said that, you know, it was like 45 to 43 or something like that. 87% of the Republican primary electorate has not made up their mind in this election. I think those are all efforts. This is a game targeted at one person, and that's Trump. That being said, I think the other reason she's cozying up to him at this point is to try to build that support among the base, showing that direct connection between him and her, I think, is to her benefit. I suspect that they'll start early and trying to get out in front of this audience and narrate. But one thing Mike said that I tend to disagree with slightly is I think Governor Hobbs would absolutely much prefer to go up against Andy Biggs than Karen Taylor Robeson. You know, it prevents the narrative that some folks have said about the last election, that it had it been Robeson and not Lake, that Robeson would have won. I also think that Biggs has challenges when it comes to his legislative record here in Arizona, as well as in Congress, you know, things like failing to restore Medicaid and other items that I think he would be vulnerable on in a general election. Whereas Karen Taylor Robeson can go to the right during the primary and then rely on her business and outsider background in the general election. Her narrative to Trump right now should be like, look, I'm a business person like you. I'm not a part of the swamp like somebody like a career politician like Andy Biggs.
Last question on this, Paul. Is there still a percentage of the GOP base, the primary voters, who doesn't trust Robeson as being right enough?
Oh, certainly. I think we're seeing that within the Turning Point group, the folks that are initially backing Biggs right away, the early endorsements of Biggs. That's certainly all part of that calculus that they're looking at.
Remember, too, that prior to this election in 2024, Karen Taylor Robeson hosted fundraisers for Chris Christie and for other candidates that were running against the eventual nominee, President Trump.
Mm,
and so,
yeah.
Again, it's a difficult thing to prognosticate 18 months from now.
Sure.
This is going to change multiple times. And that's why, again, I think from the governor's standpoint, it doesn't really matter. Let the two of them fight it out, and whoever wins, wins. And that's who she's going to face come 2026.
All right. So, Mike, let me ask you about an elections bill that the legislature passed this week. They've fast-tracked it. There were bills in both the House and Senate. They say that Republicans say that this will speed up the process of counting the votes and having the results. Sort of the big headline on this one is that if you want to drop off your early ballot, you would have to do so by 7 o'clock the Friday before Election Day. You would no longer be allowed to drop it off at a polling place on Election Day itself. The governor has been pretty clear that she's not going to sign this.
Correct. She said multiple times that she will not sign that bill. The speed of voting or the speed of results doesn't equate to disenfranchising voters in rural communities and tribal communities. And so, again, I think that this is not a serious attempt by the legislature, by the Republican legislature, to actually get a bill done and signed. This is just, again, kind of politics.
But and to that point, there the Republicans also appear to be crafting a version of this that would go to the ballot in 2 years to get around the governor's vetoing it.
Correct. And again, this has multiple additional provisions in it related to the early voting list and how you would actually have to continue to participate in that early voting list. So it's not just about election results. The other thing is, if you really wanted to get election results in time or earlier, faster in 2026, you would work to come up with a bipartisan bill that's signed into law and becomes effective before the 2026 election, rather than saying in 2025, we're going to put something on the ballot 18 months from now to maybe fix the 2028 election.
Paul, it seems as though there's sort of differing ideas between Republicans and Democrats, shocking, I know, about whether or not voters actually want faster results and care about faster results and the way in which that might happen.
Well, one thing to bear in mind is over 500,000 voters decided to drop off their ballot at a polling place on Election Day. So telling them that they can no longer do that is going to take a Herculean communications effort if you get rid of it. It also depends on how you ask the question, right? Republicans are shopping data that says, oh, this is incredibly popular to get results faster. But when you ask the question of voters, would you be willing to cut off early voting a few days early and stop the practice of dropping off ballots and making those folks vote in person? It's worth it to get results faster compared to, I'd rather continue to drop off ballots and make it, it might take longer to count the results, but everyone should have a chance to cast their vote. 2-1 would rather keep the dropping off ballots.
Keep it the way it is.
Keep it the way it is. And but you say, would you like results faster? They go shop data says, oh, absolutely. Everybody wants results faster.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they've got a little bit of a challenge on their hands. If they put it on the ballot, I don't see it being successful because
really?
I don't think people want results that badly that they want to limit their ability to vote. People like convenience. People like the ability to drop it off on their time. I mean, this is what we see. If they were to change the law, they better put a significant amount of money in there to communicate with the audience. Otherwise, they're going to have a lot of unhappy people on Election Day. Remember back when they had the presidential preference election and then independents aren't allowed to vote in that election and people were lining up and independents were kicked out of line and told they couldn't vote. Without that communication, a lot of people lost their jobs. And so if you change the rules and you don't communicate it, it's going to be a huge challenge for whoever's in office.
So Governor Hobbs, communications director, had indicated that there might be – the governor might be willing to go along with – you know, the 7 o'clock on Friday evening before Election Day, if Republicans would do other things like same day registration and things like that, does that make it more palatable to voters, do you think?
Not necessarily. Same day registration has not been a big mover among the electorate. I think that people get concerned about fraud. I think the bigger challenge that they have is this notion of that they got to confirm their address. The whole beautiful part of the active early voting list is that you signed up to vote and you get sent ballots. And as long as you vote them, you stay on the
right list.
Making extra hoops to jump through, we already see stifles and chills participation. It already works for independents. Independents can vote in our primary elections, with the exception of the presidential preference. But they're sent a postcard. They have to pick a ballot. Mm-hmm. It's a whole procedure. And that's why independents don't vote and are treated unfairly in our primary election system. This is an extension of that. If you make people vote and verify every single time, you're chilling voter participation.
Well, and Mike, this would be the second change to the early voting list, whatever you want to call it, in not that long, right? Because it used to be the permanent early voting list. Then the legislature changed it to say that if you haven't voted in the last couple cycles, you have to like reaffirm that you want to stay on the early voting list, and it was changed to the active early voting list. Do you agree with Paul that would not be a popular provision among voters?
I agree 100%.
If you had to reaffirm your address. Then.
Again, remember that about 80 to 85%, I think, of the electorate actually votes by mail.
Yeah.
And so any time that you're trying to limit their ability to do that, now they have to change their behavior. It's less likely that they're going to vote. The whole point of early voting was supposed to make it easier and more convenient for people to do it because elections are held on a Tuesday. A lot of people work on Tuesdays. And so this was a convenient way for people to participate in our elections. And like I said, it's incredibly popular. And so every time you start to tinker with that, you run the risk of disenfranchising voters. And as Paul said, you know, chilling the right to vote.
Oh, one other thing real quick. You know, we've heard the don't California my Arizona a lot. Calling this the Florida style law, I don't think does what they think it does. I don't think people want a Florida or Arizona. You see, I mean, there's shows called Florida Man, for example. And, you know, I don't think Florida or Arizona elections is something that a lot of voters will look at. I think it would ultimately be a negative connotation, not a positive one.
Oh, that's interesting. All right. That is Paul Benz. I'm also joined by Mike Hayner. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, Mike Hayner of Lumen Strategies and Paul Benz of High Ground. Mike, let me start with you on Attorney General Chris Mays is among a group of attorneys general suing over the delegation of power to Elon Musk, saying what he is doing in terms of shrinking the size of the government, closing, trying to close agencies, firing people, laying people off is not constitutional. She's had a pretty long streak of filing lawsuits over the last couple of weeks here.
She has, and she's been somewhat successful in doing that over the last couple of weeks. But again, this is a trend that we've seen, again, over the last decade or so, where, you know, whoever the party in power is does something, and the opposite party, state attorney generals, decide to sue. And so, again, it's kind of the politicization of all of our processes. The one thing that is, I think, not really talked about in this area, though, is Congress's inability, apparently, to do anything to show that they are a branch of government. Right now, they just seem to be bystanders. And whether or not you're a Republican or Democrat, that's bad for our country when the Congress just allows the executive branch to do whatever they want without any checks or balances, because that's not the way that this system was designed.
Yeah, Paul, I mean, to Mike's point, I've heard people saying, you know, look, for example, like, let's take one that maybe people don't object to that much. Trump wants to get rid of the penny and signed an executive order to do that. You know, this person was saying, look, policy differences aside, if you want to get rid of the penny or not, that's fine. But Congress is the way that you do that. You pass a bill and the president signs it, and that's how you do it.
That's typically the way it's done. What we're seeing from this administration is that they're going to fire off executive orders, and then until they get pushback, they're going to keep doing it. And we saw this with the stopping of all funding and not really realizing that a two-page memo wasn't really going to accomplish what they wanted when it came to grant funding and, you know, medical research and everything else that it was going to harm. And so they're really sort of, fire first, ask questions later. And I think, you know, what Mays is doing and other things is actually very smart, because what you're doing is putting the emphasis on Musk. And we saw this with Matt Gaetz. When the heat gets too hot, Trump is willing to drop anyone for anything. It already happened to Ramaswamy early on before it even took office. They're doing the same thing for Trump or for Musk. This is putting the heat and the emphasis and the focus on what he's doing and making him the figure so that ultimately they can get rid of him. In the meantime, you know, Musk is definitely feeling his oats. I think he is doing what he can while he's there and raising his overall profile. I mean, having his kid climbing on the Resolute desk and things. Yeah. It's a bizarre scene, but ultimately, I think it's putting Musk in the crosshairs.
Well, and there's been polling, right, that suggests that Musk's popularity is lower, in some cases considerably lower than that of President Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. And I you see the backlash on that. And I mean, anybody who's paid attention at all, it's very ironic that Musk is talking about government largesse and government handouts when the vast majority of his fortune was made on these types of government programs.
Politically, Mike, is this a smart move for Attorney General Mays to be parts of these lawsuits going after the Trump administration?
Well, again, politically, I think the proof will be in 18 months when she's up for re-election. And again, that's where things are going to change over time. But I think for her, and again, this is more, I think for her, about not the politics of it so much as, again, as Paul talked about, the overreach of Elon Musk and whether or not constitutionally, as a special government employee, he's able to actually do these things, again, without congressional approval. It just seems like it's not only good lawsuit, but it's it is good politics.
Okay. Mike, let me ask you about a bunch of Democratic lawmakers this week introduced a measure called the Immigrant Trust Act. This was done in response to a lot of the sort of anti-immigration proposals put forward by the GOP in the legislature. We talked earlier about the election bill the governor would not sign. Fair to say the Immigrant Trust Act will not see the light of day in a committee hearing?
No, I don't think that bill will be heard. Obviously, most Democratic bills introduced in the legislature are not heard, but this one in particular will likely not get a hearing and be assigned to multiple committees.
It's interesting, though, because even on the federal level, for example, we saw both of Arizona's Democratic U.S. senators support the Laken Riley Act. We've seen, some maybe movement to the right among some Democrats. Not this group, though. This group is seemingly going the complete opposite direction.
Yeah, it's understandable. Again, the party system that we have in America and Arizona, we have the far right and the far left, and they continue to keep going in those directions. And so you're going to have politicians and elected officials that do take those positions, but it's not really the mainstream of the party. And that's, again, a difficult thing for voters to understand sometimes that those far extremes do things that might not make a lot of sense.
Paul, do you think this bill has any impact politically going forward, or maybe after this conversation we're having, no one's going to remember it?
Well, immigration's the top issue in the state. It's about 32% of the electorate's number one issue, including 64% of Republicans. More than half of Republicans, immigration's their number one issue. So actually, I think in some ways, this is a benefit of Republicans. They can point and say, see, look what these guys want. You know, we even saw some of the legislators saying, I believe in the rule of law. And it gives them a place to go and say, we're offering common sense solutions. Whether or not we think that those are, in fact, the case, that Republicans can say, we're offering common sense solutions, and this is what these guys want to do. And so I think, no, it's not going to have an impact. I don't think it's going to get a hearing. I think it's a talking point that Democrats are probably on the losing side of. I think there's other issues that they certainly can score better points on, but they seem to pick these topics over and over, to Mike's point, to satisfy their base. And I'm not sure they're actually winning the undecided portion of the electorate, the swing audience, with this type of topic.
Do you think that this has any impact going forward politically? Like, does this impact, again, 18 months till the next election? Does this impact Democrats in any way, do you think?
It's part of a narrative. And again, I think that you've seen over the last 2 years, Governor Hobbs has been at the border multiple times. She's put hundreds of millions of dollars into border security. She's got the National Guard at the border. She's working with the Trump administration on how they actually implement barriers, whether they're electronic or physical, at the border. And so, again, it's part of a narrative, and I think the Democratic message needs to go back to kind of that cinema bill from a year or so ago about all the different parts of this, because it's not just what happens at the border, it's how we deal with folks if they're here and when they're coming across the border. And it's a comprehensive issue that really needs a comprehensive solution, which that bill was.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Mike Hayner, Paul Benz, thanks you both for coming in. Happy Statehood Day, guys.
Happy birthday, Arizona.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a zine celebrating an intergenerational friendship between neighbors. But first, Frida takes the stage at Ballet Arizona this weekend. It's the U.S. debut of the show, which tells the story of the famed painter's life through dance. It's further proof that Frida Kahlo has become the seminal icon of women in art, a well-earned honor, according to our next guest. Carmen Guerrero is a longtime artist and arts administrator in the Valley and executive director of the Cultural Coalition. She's been a part of many organizations celebrating Frida, from the Phoenix Fridas to the Fabulous Fridas. And she told my co-host Lauren Gilger, there's a reason Frida is close to her heart.
Let me begin with a little bit about your own personal connection to Frida and why you've appreciated and loved and celebrated her work so much here. Where did that begin for you?
It began the first time I went to Mexico and I met my boyfriend, Zarco. And he had it in his agenda. He was going to visit Diego Rivera's studio. Mm-hmm. So I tagged along with him. And even though Diego Rivera's was very impressive, very big, it was like white marble and huge, I was really taken by his wife's little house, Frida's studio right there. Mm-hmm. And I became immediately attracted to her, her cuteness and her attention to detail in what she was doing. Mm-hmm. So that was before Hayden Herrera came up with the seminal book about her, Frida, which was huge. It was like 300-400 pages, you know,
right,
detailing everything. It was the first time. I also saw homages to Frida in San Francisco. The women, the Mujeres Muralistas, they were doing murals at Mission. They also would have a party and everybody would wear flowers in their hair, you know, link their eyebrows and be Frida.
Yeah.
So that's where my love for her, my admiration for her started.
Yeah. And you created the Phoenix Fridas, right? Like you have created organizations, groups, events around Frida over the years. Tell us about that.
Well, Kathy Murillo, the crafty chica, she called me one day because she was going to all these craft fairs all over the United States and say, everybody has a group with a cute name like the Texas Tornado Girls, you know, and something like New York something. And she goes, I want to start a group called Phoenix Fridas. And I said, count me in. So we started in 2003. And for many years, we were doing her birthday celebration at the library. Mm-hmm. And we would pack that library in the middle of the heat in the summer. July 6th is her birthday. And we'd have like music. We'd have a whole exhibition. We had 10 Phoenix Fridas. They were all artists, visual artists. And we'd have kids' activities. We had music. We had ballet. And all the kids would come with their little eyebrows. They would paint their Fridas and put flowers. So we started a trend. Mm-hmm. Then when the pandemic hit, we couldn't really have those things anymore. So that's when I started the Fabulous Frida. Mm-hmm. And we're just a group of women who love to dress like her and like her. And we go to different events. Like the last one we did was in Sedona, mm-hmm, for their Dia de los Muertos. And we were just parading around with a huge puppet and a puppeteer with us. And then four of us dressed as Frida.
Yeah.
We couldn't even walk. Everybody wanted to take a selfie with us. So, you know, we became a thing, and I'm really happy that I pay homage to this iconic figure, mm-hmm, that has changed the world.
It sounds like you feel very personally connected to her.
I do, because I also see, I travel. I'm from Brazil originally, and even in my country, they have carnival blocks dedicated to Frida. So everybody, men and women, you know, are dancing around with Frida outfits, you know, Frida puppets and Frida outfits. I also go to Asia, and they know who she is. Mm-hmm. So she is internationally famous. You know,
yeah.
She's not. And then last summer, I was in Mexico in July on the occasion of the 70th year of her death. Mm-hmm. And she was everywhere, on TV, on the radio, on these buses. They have pictures of Frida. Everybody was celebrating Frida. So I kept thinking, dear, she's more famous than La Virgen de Guadalupe.
Hard to do. But and also interesting because she was not that iconic in her own lifetime, right?
No. She died young. I think she was only 52 or 53. And nobody knew her. She only had one show in Mexico.
Right.
And she was so ill that they had to put her in her bed and carry the whole bed in the back of a truck to go to the Palacio de Bellas Artes that finally gave her first show. Nobody knew her. She was so unimportant. She, you know, Diego was bigger than life. And she was just his wife.
Interesting.
But in Europe, she was very famous. She came on the cover of Vogue. Mm-hmm. And then everybody knew her. In the United States, people know her. She had lots of friends who were influential, who were writers and photographers, and documented her life. Mm-hmm. And she was also very brave and very anarchist. She painted herself nude.
Yeah.
She painted herself giving birth. You know, she just really shook all the norms, you know.
Yeah. So why do you think she's become such a worldwide icon? Like, why is it Frida who we talk about when we talk about great women artists?
I quote Dr. Sandoval when he says that she was the capture of individualism. You know, she started the whole selfie trend. Because all she painted was herself.
Right, yeah.
And she says, I only paint myself because I'm the person I know best. I think she brought individualism to the maximum.
It's really
interesting. But she was also very strong, determined. She just kept going, you know, that the disease was not going to determine who she was.
Yeah.
The accident where she almost died was not going to mess up her life. She had more fun than everybody. She was the one who laughed the loudest. She drank the most. She smoked the most, you know. So she had a great life.
Yeah, yeah. Are there specific works of hers that you think really resonate, really show that kind of perseverance that you're talking about there?
Oh, the one, the venado, the deer, that she painted, the deer that's bleeding and it has many, you know, arrows in it and wounds. And she has a beautiful face.
It's her face, right?
It's her face. She put her face in it. Mm-hmm. Very stoic. Her face is not showing any emotion. It's right. Like there's no pain here. You know, there's no fear. And she has just a little bit of a crying, you know, showing in her face. But the face doesn't show anything. To me, it shows her that she was determined to not let the disease or whatever physical ailment she had mess up her life.
Yeah.
And I also think that she brought, like, the indigeneity, because she's mixed blood, like many of us. She brought it up front and personal. She wore the outfits. She wore flowers in her hair, not just for parties. She wore it every day. You know, she wore tons of jewelry, mostly pre-Columbian jewelry that Diego collected and gave her. She wore those with pride, you know. She wore those like, this is me, this is my culture. I think that's the gift she brings to me as an artist and also to many of my friends.
So looking at this show debuting this weekend and the U.S. debut of it, which celebrates her in this really unique way, as so many things have done, what do you think about the timing of this? Like, as we're watching mass deportation start to play out, as we're watching fear start to bubble up within the Latino community here in Arizona in particular, what do you think this kind of tribute to the Latino community says?
Well, to me, it's a testament to the beauty and strength of our culture. You know, the fact that a Mexican culture is so vibrant, so alive, so colorful, so tasty. And so I feel like it's very appropriate to have this time over here now to show the beauty of our culture, you know, to share it. Because you cannot hoard your culture. You need to be able to share it so people can see it. So in a sense, I feel really good that it's really showing the best we have to offer. But it is a very sad time for our community.
Yeah, like what you say about sharing the culture and not hoarding it. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like is that a challenge?
Sometimes it is. Because I feel like the policies we have in place right now are always diminishing our worth. You're just another immigrant kind of thing. And what do immigrants have to offer? You know, they're the backbone of this country. You know, all those construction workers, all the people picking our food, all the people, you know, working the hard, dirty work are the immigrants. But they forget that those people are also part of this beautiful, vibrant culture.
Yeah. All right, we'll leave it there. Carmen Guerrero, an artist and executive director of the Cultural Coalition here in Phoenix. Carmen, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I had fun talking to you.
A local filmmaker has made his dream come true. Monty Yazzie is a self-described horror hound. The first full-length feature film he's produced, called The Dead Thing, will be streaming on the platform Shudder starting today, Valentine's Day. Yazzie has worked for the Phoenix Film Festival and International Horror and Sci-Fi Film Festival. The Dead Thing has been named one of IndieWire's 52 most anticipated movies of the year. Yazzie joins me to talk more about all of this. And Monty, what about this genre speaks to you? Why do you love it so much?
Oh, you know what? I go back and tell people that horror has always kind of been a part of my life. And whether that is through the upbringing of my parents, who introduced me to Twilight Zone and Godzilla films when I was a little kid, and just kind of stuck with me. And, you know, I always tell people that horror is this genre that you can really make a lot of different elements. So you can have a funny horror film. You can have a real serious horror film. You can have a horror film that kind of embodies all these different genres. And at the core of it as well, too, you can have a horror film that is telling something socially important. And the commentary you get from that is so valuable. And sometimes, you know, throughout history, horror, science fiction, you know, these different genres have been the place where you can talk really obviously about something critical in the world, but do it through monsters and aliens and different elements like that. And that has meant so much to me.
Yeah, I'm curious about that because I wonder if horror films offer an opportunity that maybe other types of films can't, or maybe just other types of media can't, in terms of getting at bigger issues or really serious, hard to talk about issues where, you know, yes, you can use humor, but you also can use monsters and make it about something else, but really it's about this really important topic.
Yeah, you know, throughout history, horror movie history, that element has always been critical. I always go back to George Romero's Night of the Living Dead. And, you know, this film that came out a long, long time ago during a tumultuous time in America when race relationships were at an immense conflict. This movie comes out and tells a story about, you know, poverty and tells a story about race and tells a story about all these different elements, you know, that I feel like when you unpack it all, you can really get this understanding of like, whoa, like there was something really tumultuous going on in that time period. And I like to tell people that when you watch film, no matter where it is, but, you know, especially in horror, you can really get a gauge for what society looked like at that point in time.
So how do you try to balance sort of the message of a horror movie that you want to put out with, I think, what I would imagine a lot of horror films expect, which is blood and gore and zombies and monsters and stuff that, you know, sort of goes bump in the night?
Yeah, I think a lot of that comes down to how you utilize those genre pieces, right? So, you know, what is the purpose for gore? What is the purpose for a joke? What is the purpose for a monster? And, you know, balancing those pieces and understanding that, you know, also at the end of the day, you're also trying to make something that's entertaining and you're also trying to make something that people will sit through.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's hard to sit through some movies that are going to kind of hit you over the head over and over with a message. And trying to find that nice balance point, you know, where of how you use the genre to tell your story, but also at the same time, how you're using the genre to tell something entertaining. And there is room for both of those.
How have you seen this genre evolve over the, maybe even from when you were a child watching these kinds of TV shows and movies? Like, how has the genre of horror changed over the years?
Oh, you know, with the impact of social media, right, and the impact of streaming services and, mm-hmm. and television series now becoming so much, you know, video stores were the place when I grew up where you found your movies, right?
Yeah.
And now it feels like there's so many places to find movies. There's so many different avenues to explore. There almost feels like there's too much to explore. But, you know, the evolution of the genre, you know, it goes through cycles, right? So, like, for a while, you're really into zombies. And then for a little bit, you're into vampires. And then for a little bit, you're into back to zombies. But it does this cycle. And I feel like the reason why it does that is because those are vessels. Those are vessels for storytelling. And sometimes, you know, having a story about a lonely zombie in the world and maybe they're the last ones in society is a good, great way to tell a story of isolation. You know, telling a story about a, you know, 1,000-year-old vampire who is in love with somebody immensely is a great way to tell a story about romance. Maybe a romance that ultimately some people don't have or some people yearn for. And, you know, it's those elements that you can feel like are breaking down these barriers and more people are telling stories. And, you know, I always tell people that every story is valuable.
Yeah. Let me ask you about your film called The Dead Thing, which will be streaming on Shudder, which is a streaming service specifically for the horror genre. This seems like a real labor of love for you.
It sure is. You know, I have been working in film and media production for almost 15 years now, doing short films, working on projects, helping people make their visions come to life. And, you know, about 6 years ago, I started to wonder, what's the next step? You know, you can only do short films for so long. You can only help out filmmakers for so long. How do you make something of yours come to life? And a really good friend of mine who runs a podcast, his name is Elric Kane. He has a great podcast called the Pure Cinema Podcast and the Colors of the Dark Podcast. And he kind of brought this idea up. He said, hey, man, I have this script. You know, I want you to read it, check it out. And I read it and I really connected with the subject. I really connected with the message it was saying. And I really connected with this idea of like working with a group of creative people and doing it from a small kind of on our level at that point in time, to try to make it come to life. And, you know, I like to tell people that it is the process of making this movie come to life has been both the hardest and the most satisfying, you know, labor of love that I've ever done.
What does it mean to you to have it on a streaming service where pretty much anybody anywhere who has this can see it?
It is beyond comprehension sometimes.
Huh.
Because, you know, when I grew up, it was video stores. But having these avenues now gives people more opportunity to put their films out there for people. So for me, you know, for somebody who was so excited, you know, to see a streaming site like Shudder where a horror movie fan like me can go to and find everything I ever wanted to find, you know, that could connect me to this genre that I love, and having the opportunity to show something that I've produced put on that platform is pretty amazing. And I still tell people I'm going to pinch myself one of these days. I'm going to wake up a freshman in college and wondering how I'm going to make my first film come to life. But, you know, I'd be remiss to not take it back a little farther than that. But, you know, I grew up, I'm Native American, I'm Navajo and Apache, and I grew up, you know, with connections to my family members throughout the state of Arizona. So, you know, going to movies with my mom was kind of my introduction to movies and being in a theater and a cinema. And my grandmother was the first person who allowed me to read a horror movie magazine called Fangoria Magazine. And it was her just kind of honesty of saying, hey, if you have any questions, come and talk to me about it. But like, here's like this element. And I remember being with her one time and she bought me this magazine, and that was very early on. I was probably 8 or 9 years old. Probably shouldn't have had that magazine at that time. But my grandma didn't know any better. And I remember going home with it. And, you know, I never thought that an article would be written about something that I did in that magazine. And, you know, this month, the magazine is out and there's a full article inside it.
All right. That is filmmaker Monty Yazzie. His film, The Dead Thing, will be streaming on Shudder. Monty, congratulations. Really nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. This Valentine's Day, we're thinking about different types of love. Ryan Avery is a local artist, musician, and the brain behind Related Records. They recently put together a zine called Please Celebrate Me While I Am Alive. Here's Avery reading part of the first page of the zine.
A few months before my friend Fatima passed away in their sleep, I was having a great conversation with them about death. Fatima said something to the effect of, I really don't care what happens to me after I die or how I am remembered. I just want to be celebrated and enjoyed by others while I am alive. So this is my first attempt at celebrating the lives of people that are important to me and sharing that with others while they are still alive.
Volume 1 of Please Celebrate Me While I Am Alive features Avery's 80-year-old neighbor, Sia Lord. They first met around 6 years ago, and Avery says Lord is one of the coolest and most interesting people they've ever met.
My neighbor that lived behind me was doing some sort of neighborhood party, and she was like, oh, you should meet Sia. You two are going to get along great. And we did get along great. My wife and I invited her over to our house after talking about art, because she said she wanted to see all of our things that we had in the house. And she just like lit up when she saw our house. And she was like, you have to come see my house. Our house is kind of like an art gallery or a museum. And Sia's house is the same way, but it's all like wood and concrete and recycled pieces. All of the art in her house is amazing. She does some painting. She does photography. She does collage. She does sculpture. My favorite pieces that she does is her collage. She'll do collages with her own photography, just like cutting the photos into odd shapes and then fitting them together into different things. I used to be on the board for the Trunk Space, which is a all-ages music venue. I asked Sia if she would be interested in having an art show there. And at first she said yes, and then like 2 days later said no. And that began the discussion of like, why? Why don't you want to share this with other people? And she said, I don't care to. Like, I don't care if other people like it or see it. I enjoy sharing it with people like you, and I enjoy, you know, sharing it with other close friends that I have. I visit with her probably on average once a week. Sometimes it's just for a few minutes. Sometimes it's for hours. Sarah and I will invite her over for dinner like once a month. And whenever we make too much of something, we share it with her. Sia and I will talk about everything. It's such a natural flow, like the way it is when you stay up late with a like your best friend or something. I went over there the other day to bring her something, and she just asked me about how often we're using our heater, and that led to a discussion about the way people think about heaters depending on the way they were raised. Before I knew it, I was talking to her for over an hour, and I was like, oh, well, this really was supposed to be just like, you know, a 3-minute drop off, but I just enjoy talking to her so much. Almost every time I see her, I'll ask her about her day, and I'm so jealous. She's just like, I woke up, you know, whenever I felt like it. I took care of my plants. I started making art while I drank coffee. I did some organizing. I read a book. In August, Sarah and I had Sia over for dinner. And I knew the whole time that I wanted Sia to be the first person I make a zine about. We were talking about birthdays, and we were like, Sia, when's your birthday? And she's like, oh, it was last week. And we're like, oh, happy birthday. Did you do anything? And she's like, no. I didn't tell anyone about it either. We're like, okay. I asked her how old she was, and she said 80. And I was like, well, I should get going on this project. I didn't ask her first. I just made like 5 coffees at first, because I also didn't want to go forward with making more until I knew how she felt about it. But yeah, so I just made a few, gave her the first one, and she was like, this is amazing. This is so cool. I'm so lucky to be involved with you this way. So then I went ahead and made 30. I have a few other people that I have in mind to do profiles about, but I mean, really, everyone should be celebrated more before they die.
That was Ryan Avery talking about their neighbor, Sia Lord. You can read the first volume of Please Celebrate Me While I'm Alive on the Related Records website. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.